welcome to Shalom Ottawa. You are dialed into the show that keeps you in the know about the personalities and events across Ottawa's Jewish community, as well as with our extended family in Israel. My name is Les Kalm, and as your host, I've got some fresh conversation for your head and your heart, stories you won't hear anywhere else. So keep your eyes on the road or your hands wrapped around a good cup of coffee. Sit back, relax, and join me in welcoming today's special guest, Yala.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, one and all, from wherever you are in the world. We have listeners all over the world, not just in Ottawa, not only in Israel, but we've had listeners in Japan, in Africa, the Caribbean, a little place called Florida. Welcome, one and all, to the May edition of Shalom Ottawa. And you've tuned in to a pretty special one for a couple of reasons. Number one, this is our sixth episode. We started in December with Hanukkah. This is episode number six, and that's really special because six comes between five and seven, and we'll just leave it at that. But maybe more importantly, this episode is all about books. Now, you know, the Jewish people are known as the people of the book. And of course, we refer to the Torah and its indispensable companion, the Talmud, when we say people of the book. But this episode is people of the books. And it's all about our love of books, because traditionally we have been a very book-loving people, a very literate people. And so we're going to delve into that in this episode with three exclusive one-on-one, nowhere else to be heard interviews with people here in Ottawa who are involved very much with books. Have a listen. To start off this month's episode, which is called People of the Books, where else could we find a better place to start than at a library, and specifically the JCC Library, a wonderful place, and we're thrilled to have some time with the librarian herself, Carly McPherson. Carly, welcome. Thanks for joining Shalom Ottawa.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's awesome. And we're here with you in person. We're going to walk the stacks here. We've just picked a random row. And why don't you close your eyes and point at a book? Close the eyes, close your eyes. Yeah. And just touch something at random and we'll see. Okay. What have you selected? Okay. A very interesting book on culture and history. Very interesting. Here's some books on the Zohar. Rambam, we must be in the philosophy section.
We are in the philosophy section and looking at different tenets of Judaism as well.
Okay, terrific. Different tenets of Judaism. Yes, we've heard that different Jews have different opinions, two Jews, three opinions minimum. So it's good to have different tenets represented here. The 613 mitzvot. Okay. Interesting. History of Judaism. So, Carly, we're so happy to be here with you. Tell us, you know, it all starts in childhood, doesn't it? When you were a kid, were you a big reader? Were your parents big readers? How did your love of books start?
I was a very big reader. I started reading, my parents tell me, quite early. That might just be them being a bit braggadocious, but I like to think I was reading for well before 2 years old. My parents were not big readers. Neither of them graduated from high school, but I found myself as a youngster just devouring books. I like to spend a lot of time in my own imagination, and books were a great way to do that.
Spend time in your own imagination. That's a fascinating way to put it. You know, what's also fascinating to me, I have not met a lot of Hasidic scholars by the name of Carly McPherson. So tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be here at the Jewish Community Center Library in Ottawa.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about my last name and why I'm working in the sector that I chose to work in. My mother is Israeli. My grandparents are Polish Holocaust survivors. And my father is Scottish. And so that's how my last name came about. But really, I was raised predominantly in a Jewish household. And my grandparents' unwillingness to speak about their experiences is sort of what started my interest in Holocaust studies, which led directly into the work that I'm doing now.
How did you come to apply for the position of librarian here in Ottawa at the JCC?
So that's actually one of my favorite stories. I moved here to complete my graduate degree. And then, like so many people my age, really struggled to find a job, especially since I did not have a strong French background. And my mother said to me one day, well, why don't you go apply at the JCC? And I said, I didn't know there was a JCC in Ottawa. And so quickly looked it up, applied. The first available jobs were at the registration desk. So I started there. Looked up, saw this beautiful library, and said to myself, that's where I'm going to end up. And about a year later, that's where I ended up.
And where did you move here from, if I may ask?
So usually I tell people Toronto, but this is one of the few communities where I can say that I grew up in Thornhill, and people know what I'm talking about.
Yes, we've heard about Thornhill. Okay, excellent. So you came here, we're lucky to have you, and you've overseen and grown this library. Oh, here's a book about Hanukkah. We have a special love for Hanukkah because that was our first ever podcast all of 6 months ago. It was all about Hanukkah. What do you love most about the job here as librarian at the JCC?
I mean, the books are a great part of my job, but really, it's the people and the community that we can create in a space like this. Libraries are sort of the last bastions of being able to exist without being expected to spend money. And I love being able to offer that kind of community and space to the people around us.
Life is about people. So what kinds of people do you see in here on a day-to-day basis? Tell us about some of them. No names. We have to protect the guilty. But give us some character sketches here.
The people who visit this library run the gamut from students to scholars, rabbis, regular community members. We have the OJCS school that comes and does their after-school programming here. People just looking for a quiet space, but it's everybody. We are a very welcoming open space, and everybody is welcome here.
What is the most popular item for those who come here to borrow materials? Is there a certain book, a certain kind of book? Is it mysteries? Is it philosophy? Is it the videos? What's a big seller here?
So mystery certainly is having its moment this year, and those do seem to be the most popular at the moment. Over the last 8 months to a year, Daniel Silva's book, A Death in Cornwall, has been the most borrowed book in the library. His books often are very popular. So mystery is definitely the most popular right now.
All right. Well, I am one of those mystery buffs. I love a good detective series. You even have some mysteries set and written in Israel. How is the Israeli collection going? Most of your books are in English alongside Hebrew. How easy or difficult is it to build up the Israeli literary collection?
That can be tricky because it's such a vast amount of stuff that you can pick from. So I really rely on people sort of telling me what they're looking for and then using my own research skills to find the things that might best fit the library and fit holes that exist within the collection. It's quite a task to create a collection in this library.
I can imagine. What's the most challenging part of your job? Maybe you just mentioned it, rounding out that collection and keeping it current, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What is the most challenging part of your job here?
It is making sure that we're serving as many people in the community as completely as we can. We try not to leave out any part of anything. Although we're not perfect, we do our best to fill gaps for every possible part of Judaism. And in some cases, even those who are not fully attached to their faith, to give them the resources to do that work and that research.
How many customers do you have, if we can put it that way?
It definitely, like many places, depends on the day. But on any given day, we'll see anywhere from 20 to 60 people, sometimes in groups, sometimes not. And in any given day, we're looking at about 20 to 30 books being taken out of the library, which for a library this size, I think, is really wonderful. It shows how appreciated it is in the community.
All right. So that's a bit of quick math. That's on a weekly basis. That might be closing in on 150 ish books per week, 7,500 books per year, more or less, probably a bit more. But recently, maybe about a year ago, please correct me if I'm off there, but you added the library to the Libby system, which my wife and I are huge fans of. Tell us about Libby. There may be some listeners who aren't familiar with Libby, who haven't met Libby. Maybe they think Libby is their grandmother on their father's side. How did Libby come about and how does it work?
The Libby acquisition was a really exciting project that took quite a while to come to fruition. It is an online digital catalog that allows for ebooks and audiobooks. For those who have been in the library, space is always a concern. And so it is quite limiting on some of the things that we can keep for long periods of time, or some books that may not fit the collection perfectly, but might have some community interest. We can offer those on our Libby platform. It also gives us the room to expand our Hebrew collection, which can be quite difficult with hardcover books, as well as audiobooks. We've been able to vastly expand our collection of audiobooks, and that is the most popular part of Libby at the moment. People really love to be able to listen to books.
I am one of those people who loves to listen to audiobooks in the evening, especially at the end of a day or in the car. I never thought about Libby making it easy to expand the Hebrew collection. That makes total sense now that you mention it. That's quite exciting. Is there a cost to people to have Libby on their phone or their tablet at home?
So as long as you are a member either of the JCC or the library, then there is no cost to having Libby on your phone or your computer or your iPad. All you have to do is contact me, the librarian, and I can set up an account for you.
Well, if anyone hasn't done that already, I highly recommend Libby for the ebooks, the audiobooks, and as I've just learned, expanded access to all sorts of things, whether it's the Hebrew collection or other titles that are difficult to get in physical copy here in Ottawa at times. This is just wonderful. For those who are listening to us here, Carly, and just can't wait to pay another visit to see you and the library, just remind us of your hours. When are you open for business here?
We are open Monday to Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Sundays from 10 to 3.
Fantastic. Carly McPherson, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We greatly appreciate it. I love walking the stacks. There's something about prowling the volumes of physical books and speaking with you. There's someone here who's doing some studying. So there is a kids area at the end here with a book called Space Torah. That sounds like it's something I should delve into. And a very adorable kids table and kids sofas. So there really is something for everyone. Beautifully organized, color-coded holiday books, Libby. All is just great. Come and visit again and again if you haven't been here recently. Carly, again, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much for having me and highlighting this wonderful library. I'm very proud of the work that we do here, and I hope to see a lot of your listeners coming and visiting us.
Terrific. Bye for now. Well, good morning, and thanks for joining this month's episode. We have a very special guest on Shalom Ottawa this month. And of course, our theme this month is People of the Books. And what better way to start than by speaking with an author? Ottawa's very own Barbara Fradkin, a prolific author, especially mystery stories. For those of us who enjoy mysteries, yes, I confess, I am one of those people. Barbara, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Morning, Les, and thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So let's dig in a little bit here. You know, the story behind the books, the person behind the books, you. You grew up in Montreal, my hometown. You know, gotta like it. We can talk bagels, smoked meat, patisserie another time. But as a kid growing up in Montreal, were you a big reader? Were your parents big readers? Or what was your favorite book?
I was always a reader. Reading was really important in my house. My father was a university professor. My mom was a teacher, both very educated, both very well-read. my house was full of books. Every single time, my father kept ordering books. And when we ran out of bookshelf space, he built another bookshelf rather than get rid of anything. So the halls were lined with bookcases. The living room was lined with bookcases. His study was four walls of bookcases. And I had a free run to look at those books. Mm. I read all kinds of interesting adult books quite early on when I actually probably don't know what I got out of them. I read Tennessee Williams and Faulkner and all those people, Hemingway, Russians. My father particularly liked the dissident Russian authors like Solzhenitsyn. Mm. So I read that all before I was in my teens, I was around 11, 10, 11. But I also liked, as a kid, we went to the library all the time. And I got out books mostly on animals. I loved animals, so I read books about horses and wolves. And my initial stories when I was a little kid were about me and my animals.
So you were writing stories as a kid?
Yes. I've started writing as soon as I was one of those kids that daydreamed and had imaginary friends and imaginary adventures all the time. I didn't just walk to school. I was always in an adventure while I was walking to school. That the actual footsteps to school was in the periphery of my mind, making sure I didn't get hit by a car. But other than that, I was in an imaginary world. And as soon as I could spell it all, which was around age 7, I think, I wrote my first book about a wolf. It was an illustrated book, obviously. And then I wrote all the way through my teens and all the way through my adult life. It was my creative outlet, if you like. I think writers are often like that. They're born to tell stories. They're born, that's the way they see the world. They are imagining, spinning stories about every little thing they see or do or read about. It's a possible takeoff for a story. Artists or photographers or any other kind of creative person will see the world in terms of shapes and shadows and whatever. A writer sees it in terms of personalities interacting, having conflict, the what ifs, what happened before, what happened afterwards, in any kind of little vignette we see.
So you had this creative frame of mind. You had it naturally, if we could put it that way. And you were spinning stories in your head as you walked to school and so on. What was it like? Were you, in terms of support and networks, were you alone in this? Did you have friends or amateur writer clubs that you could join and extend, share mutual support? Tell us a bit about that part.
For most of my life, I was writing just alone. It was never a thought to make it any kind of a career. It was just my creative outlet. And I enjoyed doing it in my spare time, but I never really sought out any kind of other writers. I just viewed it as something I did. Until I had accumulated a couple of Inspector Green novels in my bottom drawer. I'd written a bunch of bad novels before. I was very glad they never got published. So they moldered in the bottom drawer of my basement for the longest time. So we had a flood and I got rid of them. But I'd written a couple of Inspector Greens and I was just kind of making things up. I was just writing for the fun of it. But then I saw an ad in the newspaper. Back in those days, the Ottawa Citizen had this little column called Community Happenings or something like that, Community Events. And in it was listed this little announcement about capital crime writers who's having the chief of detectives come and talk to them. And the time and the place was listed. So I went, oh, that would be interesting. Because by then I was writing mystery. So I went along to the first meeting and I walked in the room. It was like walking into a group of kindred spirits. Everybody had the same kind of thinking as me, as opposed to most people who don't spin stories and don't imagine murders and don't wonder the best way to poison somebody or whatever. So I joined that group roughly in the early 90s, I believe, late 80s, early 90s. I'm still a member, still an active group of crime writers. And that's where I got started. And then I got a critiquing group from that group, so we read each other's stories and helped each other to gave kind of pointers and whatnot to help us.
Wow. So you see the ad in the paper, the physical newspaper. You walk into this room, you want to hear from the chief detective. That's kind of cool. Right. And there are all these other people, kindred spirits, as you say, that must have been a revelation. It must have been a wow moment. And as you're telling us, to this day, you're still involved with capital crime writers. So I guess Inspector Green had to carry on. There was no going back. Inspector Green had to have more stories.
Well, he did. I had a lot of stories in me, and he using that vehicle was a way to tell the stories. I look at mysteries as the murder is the sort of the dramatic device at the center of the story, around which the story revolves. But it's really a story about relationships and conflicts and dynamics between people and what people do when they're desperate, the choices they make. It's not about the murder solving. In my case, it's not about forensics or, you know, car chases or any of the other things that go into some kinds of thrillers. It's all about unpeeling the onion of this person's life and what was at the kernel of it that caused this dreadful thing to happen. So, yes, I joined a whole bunch of other writers' groups. Capital Crime Writers was the beginning, but then Crime Writers of Canada is the nationwide one, which I belong to. Writers Union of Canada I also belong to. And also I joined this group called, believe it or not, Ladies Killing Circle, the Ladies Killing Circle, earlier write short stories, publish them in their anthologies. I'm still friends with those people.
You're still friends with them. And okay, and there have not been any unexplained deaths or mysterious deaths. Well, it's fascinating and very interesting to hear you talk about the murder itself being the dramatic device around which you get to weave a story about your real interest, which is relationships. I've heard of relationships, yeah. And these sorts of things. So your novels weave in Ottawa landmarks and themes as well as other Canadian places. We're Shalom, Ottawa here. We're part of the Jewish community here. So we have to ask you, are there any Jewish themes or inspirations in your writing? For instance, Inspector Green. I know a few Greens in Ottawa. Is Inspector Green by any chance related to Cantor Jason Green? Or are there any other Jewish connections possibly in your writing?
I don't use real people. They would get on my case, I think. But I do use composites and bits and pieces of people that I know. Inspector Green is Jewish. His name is shortened, actually. It's completely changed from his original name by his father. Green's the son of a Holocaust survivor. Both his parents were Holocaust survivors. So that's the basis of his passion for justice and his fight for the underdog. That's what motivates him. He's not always aware of it, but he fights on the side of people who don't have a voice or whose voice has been silenced. So there's a number of Jewish themes in individual stories, but that one runs through them all. His father, by the time when I started writing the books, it wasn't so implausible that his father was a Holocaust survivor. But eventually now, it was 2025, I'm still writing about Inspector Green. So his father's long dead at this point, and he has only the memory of him that shaped him and shaped his kids. Individual stories just have little bits and pieces of his Jewish life, maybe a Shabbat dinner in one of them, Hanukkah celebrations in another one. And in this most recent one, it's his son's bar mitzvah that he's studying for. So yes, they're there. There's a couple of books that are particularly dedicated to Jewish themes, one of them being Once Upon a Time, which was written in the early 2000s about an old war crimes that was hidden. And this latest one, Shipwrecked Souls, is also harkens back to the Holocaust plus the Duchesne Commission, which occurred in the 1980s and was our first attempt to take a look at what Nazi war criminals were still in Canada.
That Inspector Green, I feel a kinship I feel a connection, and you've helped explain that to me and to our many listeners in Ottawa, in the Ottawa Jewish community. I might even run into Inspector Green at the bagel shop one of these days. Anything is possible. So, Barbara Fradkin, thank you so much for speaking with us today. You know, books are so important to so many of us. There are very few of us who can write books, who have your creative mind spinning stories, you know, every step of the way, and interacting with others and getting books written and published. That's not an easy thing to do. There are few of us who can do it, but there are many, many, many of us who love books and enjoy reading them, including your many wonderful books. So for this month's discussion of People of the Books, we're so grateful to have the chance to speak with you. And we've got to go now and pick up another book. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for the invitation and for the chance to chat, Les.
Our pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, here we go with another terrific guest on Shalom Ottawa for this month's episode, which, as we know, is called People of the Books, plural. And we're really excited to welcome another Ottawa author. Seymour Main is joining us today for a conversation. Seymour, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. And you mentioned the author of the books. It's good you mentioned that because I'm not an accountant taking care of the books, right? So I'm a different kind of book person, you know.
Okay. I see this is how it's going to go. As long as you're not a chef cooking the books, I think we're all good here. We're all good. So Seymour Main is another member of the Ottawa Jewish community. Okay, he's also from Montreal, another Montrealer like myself. But what are you going to do? He's had he is having an amazing career here in Ottawa. Seymour, you've taught actively at the University of Ottawa for over 40 years. You're an adjunct professor at Carleton at the Jewish Studies Center there. You're an emeritus professor at the University of Ottawa. May you merit it. I'm sure you do. And you are also connected with the University of Haifa, just to add to the confusion, as you would say. You are amazingly productive, something like 75 books that you've authored, translated, edited, with a particular focus on poetry and on the works of Canadian Jewish poets, whether they wrote in Yiddish or in Hebrew. Am I close? Have I captured some of the essence of Seymour here?
Well, at least in terms of the books, there are now more than 80 books. I just have a new book just came out. I worked on the writings of a dear friend who passed away 8-9 years ago, Adam Furstenberg, who was an important person in the history of the Toronto Jewish community. He never put his papered articles together, so I produced a book called The Adam Furstenberg Reader, and it includes he was a pioneer in the study of Yiddish writers in Canada, and I would say in his case, they became Yiddish Canadian. Instead of looking at these writers, poets and others, defined by the communities in which they came, either, you know, in Poland or Russia, he looked at them through a prism of how did they settle into Canada? How did they reflect Canada? And it was important because he is the one who brought to everyone's attention the fact that these writers were not just simply in exile, they were also to a certain degree rooted in Canada. And he also has a number of essays on Jewish Canadian writers in the book. He also wrote public articles and journals and stuff, so he took a selection. And I don't think he should be forgotten because he is he's somebody who was enormously active, both as a professor at Ryerson, as it was then called, and also the Jewish community, where he had one dream which he could not ever, which never really consolidated. It wasn't his fault. He wanted to have a full museum in Toronto, or even Ottawa, if that be the case, but they really wanted in Toronto on the Jewish community of Canada. What have the Jews done since they first arrived in the 18th century in Canada? And it was a wonderful vision. He had some very, he had some philanthropists who were willing to put up, you know, big money. But in the Jewish community of Toronto, it just didn't cohere. I mean, they raised a lot of money. University of Toronto was going to give them a building. And unfortunately, Adam died of illness, and he never saw that realized. It's still not realized, you know. But it's a great idea because we have a community in Canada with over 400,000 Jewish people in Canada. And yet, you know, compared to many of the smaller communities around the world, our story is told in books, but never in a museum. And I am one of those who believe that there should be a museum. There was an attempt, by the way, in Montreal years ago to do a museum for the history of the Jews of Quebec. And again, I don't know what it is when you come to a museum. The Montreal municipality gave the community a fantastic site at Ontario and St. Laurent Boulevard in the old areas. And yet the community couldn't get its act together. And so it's, I suppose that's like a Canadian trait, because you know the old joke, why did the chicken begin to cross the street and to get to the other side, they say, right? So the question right. is, why did the Canadian begin to cross the street? And the answer is to get to the middle.
Hey.
So we end up not fully, you know, realizing ourselves as a community. And I think we need to have this museum, not only for our youngsters coming along, but given the climate we're in now in Canada, something that I never would have imagined would happen, the extent of anti-Semitism that's rising up in the streets, in the public, in universities, whatever, I think a museum that would tell our story would definitely knock some of the animus in so many people who tend to think that Canada, that the Jews of Canada are not that important. I remind you that this month, May, is officially Asian Cultural Week in Canada. What people realize is that the Parliament of Canada a couple of years ago also made May the Jewish Heritage Month. But do you see anything about the Jewish community? I open up the TV in the British Columbia to watch some film there. They sell Asian Heritage Month. Jewish Heritage Month, Gurnish, nothing. It's like right across the country. The Jews, some Jews maybe in Canada, some there may be some program, but it's amazing to me, while the Jewish American community also has Jewish Heritage Month in May, they're doing things down there in the United States. But in Canada, nothing. No university, as far as I know, and no public activity that would bring in the non-Jewish communities of Canada to see the enormous contribution the Jews of Canada made to this country. So,
yes.
Part of the great is that the Jewish community is a bit Canadian, you know, and Canadian, as I said, we get to the middle. We don't realize, we don't have that extra bit of, I don't know what it is, mojo. Something is missing, you know, and we see it among ourselves and the country as a whole, we see it in the Jewish community. So I'm sorry to be like a prophet who's standing outside the walls of Parliament and saying, you know, where are we? Yes, where are we as a community? Why are we not having something going on this month in Canada? Why doesn't the CBC do something? And the CTV, why is it that we are almost an invisible community?
I won't try to answer your very good questions, but they're very well taken. What I would like to do, if we may, is turn back to when you first became, let's say, a reader. I mean, I have to tell you, I'm just amazed at the number of books. It's number 80, you said, has just come out. It's hard work being an author, an editor, a translator. It's very hard work. So let me ask you, when you were a kid, were you a big reader? Were your parents big readers? What was going on then?
Well, I grew up in the Mile End neighborhood of Montreal. I went to the Talmud Torahs, the day school, and then to Herzliya, the day high school. As a student in the Talmud Torah, we had a library, and we were encouraged to read by our teachers. But the library was, they had the Bobbsey Twin books, stuff like that. I wasn't interested. I put my sights on the Jewish Public Library, which was then the corner of Mont Royal Boulevard and Esplanade.
Yes.
And I was able to join at the age of 12. I joined my mother, I think, took me there, or I went on my own, because I had piano lessons nearby that I would go in myself and look around. And I became a member of the children's library, but I found that rather boring. I wasn't interested in children's books already at the age of 12. I wanted to read real literature. So I talked my way into becoming an adult reader at the age of 12 at the library. And I had full reign of the stacks and I could read widely. And it's like I still remember when the shock of, I knew about the Holocaust, because in my mother's family, everybody except one brother, her full brother, perished. Whole family, everybody, you know, cousins, whatever, there's just nobody survives. And my mother, on the days when she had to say Yisker and pull out the pictures of her family because she escaped just before World War II began, and I was aware of what happened, but I was in shock when there was a section on Holocaust literature that had books with graphic pictures of, you know, of people at the edge of pits and being shot, whatever. I mean, the full enormity of it began to grow in me very early. And that's because of my access to the library. Also, in the library, I met a man who used to sit there. His wife was a librarian. He was the great Yiddish poet, Melech Ravitch. He would sit there and over his cane. And I would chat with him. I was then 13, 14, 15. I would chat with him, and then when I turned 16, I had a special ticket to see him. I published my first poems in journals in Canada who didn't know how young I was. There was the Canadian Forum, which was a famous liberal journal in Canada from Toronto, and at the age of 16, I think I had a poem or two in there, which was amazing since I was a high school student. And, I showed it to Mr. Roberts when we talked about it. Roberts would talk to me. He spoke a wonderful English because even though I spoke Yiddish at home, I did not have a literary Yiddish. And if you know United Talmud Torahs, Yiddish was in a way banned by grade two because the wars of the Jewish languages, which was then raging in the Jewish world and also in Israel in the early 50s, Hebrew wanted to be supreme over Yiddish. So I didn't get a good enough education in Yiddish at the school. I still remember, you know, being before I turned 20, going to some literary events. And even one time I was in high school, they brought the great Yiddish poet of the Shoah, Abraham Sutzkever, and my life was going to be entwined with him without knowing it. I was introduced to Sutzkever by the then librarian David Rome, in Yiddish, saying, here is a young Jewish poet. Now, the word for Jewish and the word for Yiddish is the same. So his eyes lit up. He thought, wow, a teenager writing Yiddish. And I had to tell him in my best Yiddish I could muster that, no, I was a Jewish poet, but I wrote in English. And it's interesting that years later, I ended up translating his work and seeing a lot of it when I was teaching in Israel, because he lives in Tel Aviv. So that night in 1959 was a key night. I didn't realize how my life would be entwined with his and my literary work would be entwined with what he did.
So you knew from a fairly early age that you wanted to be a writer, or at least you wanted to write some things. If at the age of 16, you had your first sonnet published.
But I wasn't self-conscious to think I'm going to be a writer. All I did is I wrote and got published.
Okay.
And I knew along the way when I got to university, instead of going to yeshiva, where some members of my family want me to go because they had an idea that I should get ordained and become a practicing rabbi, I first convinced them that I'm going to go to McGill and do a bachelor's, and then we'll see what we'll see. But I went on to, all the way up to getting a PhD. So I didn't have an idea. But I knew that I would be a teacher because how else would I didn't find anything else of interest from the point of view of a job or a profession. I knew I wanted to be a teacher. And I also wanted to write on the same time, which was possible to do because many, many writers had to turn to teaching and they didn't, they weren't the doctors or some were lawyers. I mean, you want to have enough time to write. And And teaching allowed, at least I used to think, 2 months off, or even if it was a part-time teacher. I never thought, I mean, I didn't think of it, but I was being, there was some kind of destiny to move on to write, and I keep on doing it in my 20s, and I got a PhD, and I got a position right away because I was a graduate of a new discipline in Canada, Canadian Studies. There were so few. When I graduated, there were three universities that wanted me, you know, and I chose the University of Ottawa for all kinds of reasons. But I didn't think of it that way. But then, of course, as you said, by the time, you know, I started teaching and in my 30s publishing a lot, I realized, well, I have the mark of Cain on me. I am a writer.
I don't know that we would describe it that way. So I see you knew you wanted to teach. Teaching afforded you some flex time to be able to continue your writing if you wanted to. You did want to. And the snowball grew and got bigger and bigger. 80 books is just unbelievable. A particular focus on poetry, on the Jewish-Canadian experience. I won't say Yiddish-Canadian, I'll say Jewish-Canadian to be absolutely clear. Is there a common theme to your books? Or let me put it this way. What impact do you hope your books will have? Is there a particular impact or impression you're hoping to leave? Are there key messages that you're aiming to leave with your readers?
I don't think when you write, you set out, if you're writing a nonfiction book, or if you're a journalist, you may have a certain theme to say that you have in mind. But if you're writing poetry, and I write a short story as well, as a book of my selected short stories published over 10 years ago, you write because you must. It's something, it's like a compulsion, and you don't stay self-aware of it, because then you'll spoil this spontaneity. And by the way, 80 is not a lot, but you think of the fact that almost every year I would either edit or translate or publish another book of poetry, you know. So actually, if you went to the National Library, the Library and Archives Canada, looked up my name, you'd find that there's a lot of fugitive and also what they call ephemeral publications like Broadside, Little Chapbooks. They hit over 120 or 130 right now over the period of the last 60 years. So I'm always busy doing it. And I wasn't thinking of waving a flag as a writer. But if you ask me, one of the compelling things I didn't realize when it started, but I look back now with the hindsight of, old age, is that when I used to read and go to the Jewish Public Library, there was a periodical room where a lot of elderly gentlemen sat for the day. That's all they had. And they would read the Yiddish newspapers and, from left to right, whatever their position was. And there was a shelf glassed in. And Mr. Rome, when he gave me, when I began to take books out as an adult, 13, 14, 15, one day Mr. Rome took me to show me this, very proud of his shelves. One of the shelves, they were the growing library of Jewish Canadian literature, especially in English and French, mostly in English. And there were names there like A.M. Klein, Mordecai Richler, you know. And I looked at that little shelf and said, oh, it's very interesting. And I didn't realize that I would spend my teaching and life, and also as a writer to a good degree besides writing my own work, would be in a way trying to help assess, bring together the full, as they call it, canon of Jewish Canadian writing, to help show and demonstrate that this is a very important branch of Canadian literature. And if you look back, in a sense, that shelf that David Rome showed me now would number thousands of books by Jewish Canadian authors. I say 2,000-3,000 books, because there's quite a number of Jewish Canadian writers. Again, right now, because of what's going on in the world, and especially what's happening in the Middle East, we're getting eclipsed again in Canada. We had that problem in the 40s, 50s, until people like Klein and Leighton and Cohen and Adele Wiseman and Miriam Waddington stepped out into the literature of the country. Right now, there's a kind of a quiet, unspoken absence of Jewish Canadian writing or whatever in this country, I know that to a certain degree, it's funny because I have over 20 of my books in other languages. I didn't translate them. There are translators in China and Russia and Romania. But I get my books and stuff get a very wide reference point outside of Canada. But the last few years, I noticed it is almost impossible for me to find a journal that would support my writing. So my work gets published, even less recently, I had a book out in Turkey. And in Turkish magazines, they publish some of the work of my translator, translating my work. And so it's a very difficult period right now. I hope it'll turn. I'm not so sure. I think that we're a bit complacent, the Jewish community. And it could be, as one author I read the other day, a journalist, who had the startlingest comment that if Canada doesn't turn around, if anti-Semitism becomes embedded in government and the public, what we never would have thought, and what my parents never would have thought, being immigrants here, is that we may have a major emigration of Jews out of Canada to other countries. Now, of course, where would you go? There's anti-Semitism everywhere, but Jews will go to the United States. They can go to England. They definitely go to Israel, where a lot of smart, young, bright people are going now. Israel now almost has a population of 10 million people. When I first visited over, 60 years ago, it was a country of under 2 million. It's an incredible growth of a country. So while the story of Jewish Canada is really one to celebrate, we may have reached our prime. And if things don't change in the country, we may find that our young people are going to leave Canada, not make the contribution they did, because this scourge, this awful development in Canada of singling out Jews and the kind of demonstrations and acts of hatred we have seen in Canada, they're not going to endear Canadian Jews to staying here. If we find we are insecure physically, even if we start finding more and more violent actions and stuff, there may be something we never would have thought would happen, that this wonderful accepting country has turned around, and that we are going to have to get out. And we are the wandering people, and who knows where we're going to wander next. Now, if you ask, it's almost inconceivable for me. I remember I was in a conference in Israel where I taught in the 80s. I could not imagine telling anybody that Canada was not a safe and respectful country for its Jewish citizens. And yet, in the last little bit of time, I'm looking, I just don't believe what I'm seeing. And I'm not the only one. People of my generation can't believe. We had an easy time. I mean, in the years I came to university, I started to teach. I encountered anti-Semitism. As a professor at the university, I encountered it, but nothing like what we're facing today. And what we're facing today, I'm fearful, may turn around the community itself and the younger people, and more of our young people will leave, and we'll lose that, the continuity and strength in our community. And what we took for granted may not happen. So I'm sorry to sound like a dire old prophet, but it's astonishing to me what's going on in Canada,
A lot of people are astonished, and we share your concern. We hope it doesn't come to that. Absolutely not. But your concern is very well understood and shared. So let's press pause here. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today. I also want to thank you for sending me an advance e-copy of your new book on Adam Furstenberg, called Transplanting Roots. I'm going to be reading this advance electronic copy with great interest. And it's just been a delightful conversation. I encourage everyone listening, go to the library. We have a library here. We have a lovely library here at the Jewish Community Center. You can go to the National Library, wherever you want, and check out some of Seymour Main's books to gain an extra insight and understanding of the Jewish-Canadian contribution, particularly in the world of arts, culture, poetry, and other writings.
Seymour. I'll add a word to your wonderful, flattering sum up here, but to help my publisher, who is a small publisher, who's very dedicated to me and to my writing. He's not a Jewish publisher, but he's been publishing my work. I would like to draw people's attention, especially the Ottawa community, to a book of my short stories that came out in 2012 called The Old Blue Couch and Other Stories. And there are in there, I think in the book, three or four what I call shul stories. And two of them reflect on my experience of being a member of two synagogues in Ottawa over the years. I won't say the names. And they're all humorous stories with serious themes. But the I think people would like the book. The book is, I don't know if the, I know the Ottawa Public Library, one of my friends told me, has a copy of the French version, a translation which came out in Quebec. But I don't know of the English version, but I'm sure there's a way to get it. And or put my name in search and buy a copy. Or if you're a member of Amazon, I think you can get a free Kindle copy of it. And I think you'll read it and you'll find it both interesting and amusing.
Interesting and amusing. We love that. So the name again, Seymour, is
The Old Blue Couch and Other Stories, published by Ronald P. Fry, F-R-Y-E, and company, whose offices and plant are located in St. Catharines, Ontario.
The Old Blue Talus and Other Stories.
Oh, the Old Blue Sofa, not Talus.
Oh, Sofa. This is where I was getting stuck.
You gave me an idea. I should write. I wrote a poem on my Zadie's Talus when I was small and it's so big. It's an interesting idea to write about on someone's Talus. I think somebody has done it in Canada. There's one of the writers did a story about a Talus, you know.
Okay, The Old Blue Sofa and Other Stories. I'm going to look for it. And if the JCC Library does not already have an English copy, I'm going to ask them to get one. Thank you so much. Something else? Yes?
I was going to tell you, it's The Old Blue, I made a mistake, The Old Blue Couch, but it's also available, and it was published in Israel, and there's a Hebrew translation of it too. I don't know if you can get it here, maybe through the Library of Congress, but if those who want to read, there's a lot of Israelis in town. You may want to read it in Hebrew.
In Hebrew, also, okay.
Spanish version published in South America, which is available too. A Romanian edition, if you're a Romanian, you know. So the book has had a life of its own.
Amazing. The Old Blue Couch and Other Stories.
Right.
Wonderful. Seymour Maine, thank you for setting us straight on that. And thank you so much for a great conversation. We've really enjoyed talking with you.
Right. So all I have to say to you is Zygosum and Stark. That's it.
So there you have it. We are the people of the book and people of the books. Three exclusive interviews, great conversations with people right here in Ottawa who are so involved with books. If this doesn't make you want to run out to the JCC Library or pick up a Barbara Fradkin or a Seymour Maine book, I don't know what will. Now, our regular listeners know that in every episode so far, we like to connect with our family in Israel. And our idea here was to reach out to Stymatsky, the wonderful bookseller in Israel. You can find their stores all over the country, from Ben Gurion Airport to just about everywhere. But we were unable to reach them, sadly. And you know, it's a special year for Stymatsky. It's their 100th anniversary. This bookstore was started in 1925. Imagine that. So we will just wish Stymatsky Yom Huledet Sameach, happy 100th birthday. And the next time you're in Israel, stop by, wish them a happy birthday personally. That's it for today's episode. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors. We love getting more listeners. Have a great rest of the month, and we'll speak with you in June.
So, how is that for you? Did you enjoy today's show? Drop us a line and tell us. Don't hold back on your feelings. It's not healthy. While you're at it, share your ideas for future guests and topics to keep the Ottawa and Israel stories flowing. And since you're a sharing person, let your friends know about Shalom Ottawa. Don't let them miss out. Of course, be sure to follow us on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you'll be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until the next time, Lehitraot and Shalom Ottawa.